to you, men, and thanks for joining us for another episode of the Morningstar Men's Weekly Podcast. This week, we're in a new series. It's called Sin, Stupidity, Sanity, and Security, and with a little bit of emphasis on that second word, stupidity. Hey, you know, I think the church does a great job talking about sin, and we all, or many of us at least, get that concept about sin. But what about the things in your life that derail you, that just mess up your life and mess with your head, that really aren't specifically sin? They're just the dumb things that you've never learned. And or maybe you've been too stubborn to hear the correction or the rebuke of someone, or maybe you've just never heard it. How do we become wiser with age? I think sometimes we take that as a given, that as people age, they get wiser. Well, I think we all know people that disprove that theory. So what I'd like to do beginning this week is explore ways in which you and I can become wiser as we grow older. And wisdom we're going to define, as you'll see in this episode, wisdom we're going to define as the ability to make good choices in almost every circumstance, not only about issues of morality and ethics, but also about basic human relationships, about what to buy and when, about who to befriend and why, all those kinds of things that go into developing a rich life. So prepare to write some notes down, capture some thoughts. There's going to be a lot here for you to meditate on in the week ahead. So I hope you're going to be not only encouraged, but I hope you're going to be inspired and maybe consider making a few changes in your own life. Thanks, and we'll catch up with you again next week. Okay. Everybody have a handout by now? I see John has gone halfway through the material. He's got his Bible open, looked at three scriptures already. Should we just pray and close now, John? Or... All right, so as you can see from the title, Sin, Stupidity, Sanity, and Security, it was my intent to do a series of undetermined length through the book of Proverbs for most of the summer. And then I was listening to John last week, and as often happens when I hear him speak, I'll get some idea from what he says, and then I have no idea what he says for the next 10 minutes because I'm taking notes or doing something. And he's talking about sin, and for some reason the word stupidity just came to mind. And I think the church does a phenomenal job about speaking to the issue of sin. We're really good at that, right? We kind of specialize in that. We're good at seeing it in others. We're good at seeing it in society. But what about stupidity? And if you think about it, how much of your life has been derailed by sin, and how much of who you are and where you are, and I don't mean the good parts, but I mean the unpleasant parts, is just plain dumb. You got there because you were momentarily, or for a season of your life, dumb. Am I the only one in the room who's experienced that? Am I the only stupid person in the room? And so, when you read through the Proverbs, it's one of the few books of wisdom literature that really addresses this. Here's how we might say it. There's a lot of things that you want to avoid because they are destructive, they are harmful, they are hurtful, and they are sin. And then there's a whole other body of things that we do that are not necessarily sinful, they're just not smart. And at the end of life, I think we want to be known as people who were both righteous and wise, righteous and intelligent. And so we'll start with this definition. It's one that we began a couple of weeks ago. What is wisdom? The ability to choose a particularly right course of action or thought in almost every situation. Stop there for a moment and ask yourself, what are the decisions that you had to make in the past week? I mean, apart from what to have for lunch, I don't mean that kind of a decision. Although even that can be a decision where stupidity would enter in. Have you had to make any choices, big or small, in the last week, for which there was not a clear-cut scriptural answer? And this is where we enter the realm of real wisdom. as we said a few weeks ago. The Scriptures talk in detail about a lot of things. They're somewhat less specific, maybe a little vague about a whole other body of things. And then about a lot of the things that we have to choose regularly, they're very silent. So, do you have the bananas and oranges for breakfast, or do you have the sugar-coated jelly-filled donut for breakfast? Which do you have? Well, is that a sin issue? Or is that just a stupidity issue? What about relational situations in your life? The things that you say that aren't inherently sinful, but they're not inherently helpful either. Am I the jokester in the room? Or am I the man who brings some degree of worthwhile, uplifting conversation to the gathering? Well, what are the other things that we... Financial decisions. How many of you think, looking back on it, that you've made any sinful decisions with your money this week? I hope not. How many of you could say, well, maybe I made a couple of stupid decisions with my money in the past month? Right? Big difference. And I think more of our undoing in the church is not the result of the out-and-out blatant sinful choices that we make. It's a matter of the small and everyday less-than-wise decisions that we make. So we'll jump down to the next statement. We are wise to the extent that we can choose well in the broadest and most diverse array of situations. This is critical. If the greatest gift that we are given by God is free will and choice, what good would that gift be if we never knew how, we never learned how to choose well? How many of you have had six-year-old kids? Would you let them make unrestrained choices for hours or maybe days or maybe weeks of their lives? Would you just let them live unattended? Why not? Well, apparently you all heard that it was a bad thing to do because none of you has any conclusive first-hand reasoning behind it. Bill?
They don't have the experience to make any decisions.
Okay. Do they have the ability to choose? Okay. So they have the ability to choose, but they wouldn't necessarily make the best choices. And so as a parent or as some other adult influence, hopefully a smart adult influence, you or I apply some restraint to their decision making because they're not fully equipped to decide yet. That's easy to see in a six-year-old, isn't it? What if it's just as true? Now, how many decisions does a six-year-old have to make? Let's take the go play in traffic one out of the equation, and let's make it more sane here. How many decisions does a six-year-old have to make? Not really. And yet, as parents, we wouldn't let our six-year-olds decide. How many decisions does a 40-year-old have to make? A 30-year-old? A 20-year-old? Would it surprise you if I were to suggest that for a lot of us, we are less equipped to make decisions that we have to make than the six-year-old is to make the decisions that he has to make? What if over a period of time we've made more destructive decisions, destructive to ourselves or destructive to others, than the six-year-old might have? What if we're the ones who need some attending and some restraint? Now, I suspect that every one of us in the room knows someone whom we could... Maybe there is a face that is right now coming to mind. Yep, that person really does need some restraint. But I think, and here's the frustrating part, because most of you came today feeling pretty good about yourselves, probably. It's my first mission in life to make you at least look at yourselves and say, do I make wise decisions in all areas of my life? Am I empowered and equipped to make wise decisions? When you walked in that door this morning, you probably thought of yourself as a reasonably wise person. What I want to suggest is that every single one of us possesses great wisdom in some areas, but it masks the fact that we don't have wisdom in other areas and we still make bad choices. I can be wise financially and stupid relationally, or vice versa. And the fact that I am wise in one area of my life is absolutely has no guarantee that I will be wise in another area. And yet over a period of time, I think that we as adults draw the conclusion, well, I know how to do this, I know how to do that, therefore I'm reasonably wise. Do you know how the Proverbs describe the fool? We're going to look at those four types of people that the Proverbs talk about, but the fool is classified as that group of people who thinks that they know enough that they don't need to know anymore, and thinks that they know enough that they never need to take the counsel of someone else. That's the fool. But if I think that I am wise in most areas of life, then what's the likelihood that I'm going to reach out for wisdom from others? See, here's the difficult part. When you're 16, the entire adult world is trying to give you advice. They're desperately trying to give you advice. And you don't want to listen to it. When you're 35, how many people do you know that are still trying to give you advice? Apart from your wife on a bad day. Who's still seeking you out to give you advice? Probably no one. And so by the time I become an adult, who then would have to be responsible for my securing additional wisdom? It would all be on me, wouldn't it? For the most part, it would all be on me to determine if I needed wisdom, where I needed wisdom, and to whom I was going to go for wisdom. So here's a real gut check moment. Do you know the broad categories of life where wisdom is required? And do you have sources of counsel for each one of those broad areas? Because I don't think they can be the same source. Don't make the mistake of thinking that just because you listen to, read, hear from one person for one thing, that they are your best source of wisdom for something else. If you read the book of Proverbs with discernment, what you're going to see is that it takes a great deal of effort to become a wise individual and to surround yourself with a variety of counsel necessary in order to be progressively and increasingly wise. Another reflective question here. How many of you believe that some of your best years are still in front of you? How many of you want that to be true? Then when is my search for wisdom complete? It isn't. And yet it's an exhausting process sometimes. Let's be honest, isn't it easier to just choose and move on? Instead of doing the homework, doing the research, seeking out the counsel of other people? Here's the next. And I can't answer all the questions at once. That's why this is a multi-week series. So if you don't like the way in which I'm approaching this, it's okay. I'll probably catch up with what you would start with first. It just will be in week two or three. When you and I begin our adult journey as citizens of planet Earth, we're looking for wisdom that helps us to construct our lives. And yet, progressively, over a period of time, there's a shift happens. And it's like everything else. When did you realize that you had gray hair? Just turn away for a moment. It's okay. When did you first realize you had gray hair? Was it when the first one came? Was it the 20th? It's hard to tell, isn't it? Well, not anymore. It's not hard to tell. No, but there was a time when you were a little uncertain.
You see one of those old pictures of yourself.
At first, you seek wisdom from which to make your life. And after a while, the choices that you have made, the wisdom that you had, starts to build your life, and then you live inside the world that you have created. At first, you're looking to create a world, And then later on, the world that your wisdom and you have built is the world that you live in. How do you like the world that you're living in? And I know that's an ouch moment. Sometimes it's an ouch moment for me. You ever realize that the person that was most responsible for the dilemma you're in is the person you see when you go to the bathroom and look in the mirror? And you've tried to counsel this person for years of his life and he just won't listen. Ask this question. Are you satisfied with the life that you have built? If you had to do it all over again, would you build it the same way? It's a little bit out of order from what's on your notes, but I was flipping through the radio dial. There was honestly nothing on NPR that I wanted to listen to. And I went down to... I was kind of like not sure. I went by Word FM and I listened to that for a minute. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever listened to Word FM, but occasionally they have somebody on who's doing some short testimony. Well, God did this in my life or God's doing that in my life. And usually I kind of turn them off because I don't know if I turn on at the wrong times, but it's usually women describing sappy emotional things that God has done in their life that I kind of just want to turn off because they make my stomach churn and make me nauseated. Sorry, that's just a personal testimony. That has nothing to do with the morning. And maybe it wasn't even wise for me to say that. There, I'll just get that out. Well, this voice was a little different. And so I stopped for a moment to listen. Have you ever heard a voice that you can tell is the product of too many cigarettes and too much bourbon? Do you know what I'm saying? You can understand the words, but you know that's an experienced voice. And the experienced voice was at the tail end of finishing up something about the fact that she and her adult son were struggling to find a place to live. But that she had confidence that God was going to help both she and her adult son to find a better place for them to live. Longer range housing arrangements. And then she made this very telling comment. She said, "But right now I'm dealing with another issue that I thought I had put behind me." She says, "I'm trying to overcome my chronic struggle with gambling." Well, now the first thing that goes off, I wonder, now I didn't hear the beginning of this testimony, but I wonder if the long-term struggle with gambling has anything to do with the short-term dilemma of not having adequate housing. Now, I didn't have enough information to draw the conclusions, but here was the other, and I think more frustrating thought to me. Is it harder to make wise choices the older you get if you have sowed so many seeds of bad choice and have harvested so much difficulty in your life? Do you actually habitualize yourself to making bad choices? Don't make fun of me. You try saying that. Is it possible? We know how the mind works. We know how habit works. Is it possible that if I live a life of bad choices for 20 or 30 of my adult years, that it becomes progressively more difficult for me to make wise choices and continue to make wise choices?
We'll see that. Yeah. So that's what they really did. We'll see that.
And yet when you're 20, you wouldn't believe that. And when you see the stories of people, hear the stories of people, live next to those people who are in their 50s or their 60s and they're struggling every day just to get through life, what's the conclusion that we draw? I believe one of the conclusions we draw is that could never happen to me. I would never be that dumb. I would never make those kinds of choices. Remember what I said? I believe that every person in this room, and I'll start with myself, is wise in some areas of life, and very much lacking in wisdom in other areas of life. And the areas where we are wise tends to mask the areas where we are less wise. What lack of wisdom is hiding in the shadow of the wisdom that you do have in another area of life? That's the question. Let's turn over to Judges 21.
What you said, just a little bit in this, I think is very important, because that's why I was looking at it. I just read it recently. You know, the wise receive instruction and get wiser, and the foolish man or foolish person does not receive instruction and remains foolish. You know, and that is so true.
All right, Judges, the 21st chapter, the very last verse in the chapter, which is verse 25. So a little bit about the book of Judges first. It probably encompasses about 200, 250 years, something like that. There's a nice even dozen people described here. We'll call them heroes. The people that, and it's a bizarre mix, let me tell you. These are not heroes like Marvel would make, right? They're a very mixed bag of people. There are people that God has chosen at one time or another to get His people out of one dilemma or another. And if you've read the book a few times, you already know the cycle. We follow God, things start to go well, things start to work in our communities, things start to work in our families, but over a period of time, there's a degree of degradation, and we follow God a little bit less, we're a little bit more lukewarm, and then pretty soon we're indifferent altogether, and pretty soon we're doing whatever we want to do, and society and family and everything spirals out of control. The bad guys from outside our territory move in, they do bad stuff to us, we live in oppression. And so God has to send in another deliverer. So that's essentially the cycle. And it happens again and again and again. These are probably not all chronological stories. There might be a hero that God raises up in one part of the territory and a hero that God raises up in another part of the territory. So there's a little bit of overlap here in the timeline. And then these stories have to all be compiled. So it's nobody really knows who is the compiler. It could have been like Samuel, but it might not have been. But here is the compiler's footnote. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. There's so many directions that we could go with those couple of thoughts, and we're going to try to capture the big ones. First off, how many of you woke up this morning and said, I am going to do what is wrong in my own eyes? Most of us not. So the real dilemma isn't that we're violating what we think is right. The real dilemma might be that what we think is right at any given moment might not be the best course of action. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so let's back up to the beginning of the verse. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Now, this book is kind of like sandwiched between two accounts of God taking one individual and being particularly influential in this man's life and allowing a good leadership to take place. So we have the entire time frame of Joshua's leadership. And we can almost imagine that this compiler of this history is looking back. There was a time when there was a good leader. And then we can also imagine the compiler looking around. He says, I see that country and that country and that country. And they have good leadership. They have someone who is uniting them. And then there's almost a wistfulness about it. In those days, there was no king in Israel. So we might even think that the writer is writing at a time when there finally was a king in Israel. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and perhaps there was a king, and his leadership was effective at the moment when this thought was penned. And so he says, I can see the difference that wise leadership makes, both to individuals and to families and to entire countries. Wise leadership makes a difference. In those days, there was no wise leadership in Israel. Everyone did what was right, or we could say wise, in his own eyes. Not everything is sin. Some things are just stupid. How many of you have a family of at least four? How many of you would say that you universally agree about what to do? Vacation, where to eat, how to manage your money, do you buy this car or that car? How many of you, family of four, how many of you pretty much agree about everything? If a family of four can't agree about what's wise, how could a country possibly agree about what's wise? So we're setting ourselves up for something. It's going to take a while to get there, but just bear with me. Now, interestingly enough, this is not the only time. If you go back to Judges, the 17th chapter, same comment. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. At two other places in this relatively small book, the author makes this commentary, and there was no king in the land at that time. And it's as if there's this sense as he's writing it, oh, here we go again. I got to write this story. I wonder if there was any leadership taking place. Nope, no leadership taking place. Nothing wise. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes. When Joshua took his hands off the throttle and off the wheel, in other words, when Joshua died, the country was relatively stable and walking in the right direction. If you remember anything about Joshua's final address, he says, "Choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And he makes that declaration. And it's a public event. And we assume that most of the people rallied behind that. And they said, yes, this is the way we want to walk. 250 years, give or take, plus or minus. It's a mess in Israel. And it's not just one mess, it's repeated messes. Take this very seriously. How many of you would like to see the family that you are part of continue on in a good way for the next 100 years? Should you have 100 years? Yeah, who wants to wish on their family despair and poverty and wretchedness? The story of this book is the story of people doing what they thought was right in their own eyes, and generation after generation after generation, it continued to go downhill. Remember Noah? See, we could say this is the book of Judges, but that's telling this story, but it's not. It's the story of humanity. When humanity does, each of us, what is right in our own eyes, bad things tend to happen. And this ties right into the king and kingdom principles that we looked at for a few weeks. A good king is looking out for his subjects. He's looking to protect them. He's looking to provide the right environment for them. Turn over to Proverbs 29:18. I've intentionally never used this verse before because it is like so overused. But it just seems so appropriate here, I can't avoid it. Proverbs 29:18. Now, most of you have probably heard the thumbnail sketch of this. Where there is no vision. Anybody? What? Where the people perish. Depending on your translation, that might not be all that it says. It says, where there is no prophetic vision, people cast off restraint. But blessed is he who keeps the law. Where there is no inspirational vision originating with God, people cast off restraint. Start with the latter part of that verse. Why do people cast off restraint? What is restraint?
Self-control.
The desire also to live under a certain rule, right? Remember the verse before? In those days, there was no king. And everyone did what? What was right in their own eyes. Does it require, I'll be right with you, does it require any self-restraint to do what's right in your own eyes?
No,
it doesn't, does it, Ron?
It sounds like a description of what today's meeting.
Shh! Don't rush ahead. Now that was a spoiler. Come on. Where there is no prophetic vision, the people cast off restraint. Have you ever wanted something big and important and good in your life? Pick something. Hopefully it was bigger than a steak dinner. I mean, have you ever wanted something really big? I don't know, a house, an education, a wife? Anybody? Just give me one head nod so I can move on. Even if you don't mean it, nod your head. Thank you. Did it require sacrifices?
Sure, yes.
The bigger, the more noble, the more worthwhile the item, the more you are likely to be willing to restrain yourself. Would that be true? If you have no vision for your money, what's a good use for your money? Anything? If you have no vision for your future career, what's a good thing to do with your time now? Pretty much anything, isn't it? And isn't anything a lot like what's right in your own eyes? Because it will be what's right in your own eyes in the moment. Where there is no vision, people have no restraint. Where there is no vision from God, people may be in doubt about whether the sacrifice is worth it. So here's a general formula: small vision, small amount of restraint; large vision, large amount of restraint. Have you ever sacrificed for years only to get somewhere and find out that you didn't want it? So, trustworthy vision, trust in restraining yourself. Small vision, small restraint; large vision, large restraint; trustworthy vision, worthy of the restraint. Those are the three components that we need to remember. Have we ever seen leaders, even of a country, who portrayed and painted a vision of the future and we thought, that's not a good vision. I don't want to go there. It's not enough to have a vision. And this is why this verse is so often misapplied. It's not enough to have a good vision. We're in church, so I can say this. You need to have a godly vision. Because a good vision isn't enough. How do we know that the guy who's providing the vision isn't just another one of the, and in those days, everyone did what was right in their own eyes, guys? What if that guy's vision is a vision where your goals are subjugated to his so that he gets what he wants, but you don't get what you need? In whose vision are you going to trust? In those days, there was no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Where there is no prophetic vision from God, the people will do almost anything, because when there is nothing worth sacrificing for, today is the best day to live for. Let's turn over to Romans. First chapter. I apologize. Sometimes we go through some of the same scriptures again and again. I guess we do it because there's a lot in them. We're just going to start at verse 16. So far we have kind of like hinted around and danced around the idea that each of us can be very self-destructive. We're not going to mince words now. Now we're really going to just jump right into it. So here's Paul, chapter 1, 16, personal testimony for a moment. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation for everyone who believes. Now we have said here again and again, so I'm not going to repeat the whole thing, but the gospel message that Paul is describing is so much more than, wouldn't you like to confess your sins to Jesus so you can go to heaven one day? The gospel message that Paul's describing starts with the narrative in Genesis and moves right through all of the Old Testament, and it talks about God's desire to have a relationship with people, the gospel. God's desire to be a good king. Again, one of those things that the writer might have been thinking about in Judges. See, the people actually did have a king, incidentally. I'm sure you knew that, but let's just park there for a moment. The people actually did have a king when the writer said in those days there was no king. The problem is that the people had rejected their king. Who was their king? God was their king, but they didn't want God as their king, so they cast him off as their king. Let me put a parenthesis in here right now. The most difficult thing to do is live under the rule of someone who gives you choice and freedom if you will not apply any self-restraint to your life. The reason that most people want good human leaders is because they don't possess the restraint to live under the rule of God. Because God will ask. Don't ever let anybody tell you that God is constricting. God will ask, but not force. Human leaders force when they get sick of asking. God says it differently. Okay, fine, if you don't want to live under my rule, then go experience life under your rule and see how it works for you. Do you know how long it takes to find out that life under your rule doesn't work? For some of us, it takes our entire lifetimes. And then we look back and we realize, oh my, I've just squandered the one and only life that I'll have here. Experimenting with something that's been done thousands of times before. I didn't need to really experiment with that and learn firsthand that life under my rule doesn't go well. I could have just trusted the lives of thousands of other people who've tried the same experiment. This is the gospel that he's not ashamed of. That God is a righteous king, that he's come to have relationship with his people, and he invites them into fellowship with him. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Remember what we said in that proverb? I have to trust the leadership. This is part of the faith. Am I willing to trust that God is a good leader and I can live under his reign? For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And this is the time in the morning where I say the same thing that I say every time. If you have a real Bible, the kind that you can underline, you might want to underline that. If you have an imitation Bible, it calls for you to put pretty colors in certain areas, then put the pretty color right there. Unrighteousness can suppress the truth. That means that the more I live in a particular way, it can blind me to other ways. Have you ever wanted something so badly in the moment that you cast off restraint and got exactly what you wanted? What do you do with what you've got that you didn't want now? You have a story to tell yourself. You can either say, oh, well, this is okay. Or you can repent and say, oh, maybe this wasn't okay. I made a mess of things. See, the deeper I get into the quagmire of untruth, the more I have to defend my actions. This is why things spiral out of control. They don't spiral out of control because one day you make a bad choice and then you look at it and you say, wow, that was a bad choice. I'm going to go back and I'm not going to do that again. Things spiral out of control because one day you make a bad choice and it takes you to a different place than you wanted to go, but you defend that course of action because you're the fool. And the fool is wise in his own eyes. And the fool who is wise in his own eyes is never going to repent and say, I made a bad choice, I was foolish. And in that way, the truth is gradually and progressively repressed and restrained. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. I love the part here that Paul just acknowledges. For his invisible attributes, It's not seen. We have to take some things on faith. But there is enough evidence here for me to draw reasonable conclusions that there is a God out there who is interested in my personal affairs and who is interested in a right way of living. And so here's how it describes him. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking. Here's a three-step progression. You cannot live right until you come under God's rule. You cannot live right until you have made a conscious choice to repent of you being king of your life and allowing God to lead your life. And out of that, you will experience a different quality of life that leads you into worship of God. And only the person who is appreciative or thankful to God is a person who is really fit to live under His rule. Remember, God grants us freedom. God says, I want you to want to live under My rule. If you have to, for a little while, exert restraint to taste and see if My rule is worth living under, that's a good intermediate step. But in the end, the citizens of this kingdom that God is describing here are citizens who have experienced the blessing of living under God's rule, desire now to live under God's rule because they've experienced goodness in the past, and they express continual thankfulness to God for the fact that He is providing good rule. So that's a good way for us to test where we are. Are you willing to live under God's rule, and are you thankful for the opportunity and the privilege to live under God's rule? Because if we haven't gotten to the thankfulness part yet, maybe we're either somewhere in the middle, learning how to live under God's rule and seeing if it's worthy of experience, or we're still living in a form of mild rebellion. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God and give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking. So if you could draw a line, you'd want to draw a line from unrighteousness that suppresses the truth leads to futility in thinking. Because we have talked about this key verse before, I know that many of you will be able to describe what futility is. And you'll do it eloquently. So who wants to be the first one to describe futility? What is? Oh. That is not funny. To be futile is to produce no good result. So what is futile thinking? It is thinking that could not produce a good result. So if your thinking is no longer informed by the truth because you have suppressed the truth, then what is the kind of thinking that you will have? It is futile thinking. Where's futile thinking going to take you? To futile places. But here is the difficulty. For although they knew God, they did not honor God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. The most difficult place to be is the place where you do not know, but you are not even aware that you do not know. The bus is coming my way and I am standing in the middle of the road, but I do not know that the bus is coming my way. That's a bad place to be. But look, there's more. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. See, it's okay to not know if you either know that you don't know or you at least allow for the fact that you might not know. But here's what suppressing the truth, which makes your thinking futile, starts to produce in you. We claim to be wise, even though we're foolish. Do you understand? When I start to suppress the truth, It makes my thinking unreliable and unstable. My unreliable and unstable thinking makes me think that I am good enough to make decisions on my own apart from any just king or God. And what is the writer or the compiler of the book of Judges report about what happens when a country of people each decides to do what's right in his own eyes? Destructive cycle after destructive cycle after destructive cycle. And look at what it says. And therefore God gave them up to the lusts of their heart, to impurity, to dishonoring their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. This was their choice. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And over a period of time, this is what happened. Now, I want you to jump down. We're going to ignore that part in the middle. Not because it's not worthy of looking at, but because that's a subject for another day. What are you staring at me for? And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind. That's a mind where futile thinking would take place. To do what ought not to be done, and they were filled with all manner of unrighteous evil, covetousness, malice. They were full of envy and murder and strife and deceit and maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil. In other words, this is an interesting phrase right here. Why he throws that in, I have no idea. He says, it's as if there was not enough bad crap in the world that you could do already. These people had to construct some more bad stuff just to be innovative. Disobedient to parents, foolish, fatherless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they knew God's righteous decrees that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. Now this is a really slippery slope. Because here's the funny contradiction about people who do what's right in their own eyes and tend to endorse other people who do what's right in their own eyes. How many of you think that the person who is just murdered by the person who thinks it's right to be murdered would endorse that activity? Do you see what I'm saying? When we do what's right in our own eyes, we're actually destructive to each other in addition to ourselves. And so when we pretend as a society, here we go, Ron, we're headed in the direction you want to go. When we pretend as a society that everything is okay, and I'll be tolerant of you and you'll be tolerant of me, well, tolerance is a bad word. I'll allow you to live your life your way and you allow me to live my... When we do that and call ourselves enlightened, what kind of thinking is taking place? Everybody? Futile thinking. Why is futile thinking taking place? Because the truth of God has been repressed or suppressed. So this is almost a formula. Suppress the truth of God, end up with, now we'll call it stupid thinking. It's both sinful thinking and stupid thinking. Suppress the truth of God, end up with stupid and sinful thinking, end up doing all this laundry list of bad stuff. You're not going to do it all, you'll just do the part that you happen to like. Because after all, it's your eyes. You're only going to do the part that's right in your eyes. And here's the bizarre thing. Almost every person that you meet has some standard. Do they not? Certain things are right and certain things are wrong. And it doesn't matter how far we stray in one area, we have standards in other areas.
Sure. We justify.
So there's real shock. You'll see it in the newspaper. Nobody reads the newspaper anymore. But the newscasts or whatever. How could they do this? And then 6 months later, that guy gets caught in something else. When we become wise in our own eyes and do what's right in our own eyes, we're forced to suppress the truth and no good result comes from it. All right, turn over to Hosea 4. This is the one time where if you have an electronic scripture, you are at a decided advantage. You're probably there right now. Holy cow, he is there. Are you there?
No.
Oh.
I'm here.
Well, that's good. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land. Here is his report about what there is, though. There is swearing, there is lying, there is murder. And swearing is not what we would take it to be, meaning just saying bad words. There is swearing as in taking out oaths, perhaps in a courtroom saying, where I'm testifying against you and I'm testifying falsely. In other words, I'm either slandering you or I'm making up lies about you that would allow me to profit from those lies. That's the kind of swearing that we're talking about. There's swearing and lying and murder and stealing and committing adultery. They break all bounds. What are bounds? Restraints. They break all restraints. What happens when there is no good vision that the people take seriously? They cast off restraint. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, and this is somewhat poetic language, the land mourns, and all who dwell in it languish, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, and even the fish of the sea are taken away. Let no one contend, let no one accuse. For with you is my contention, O priests. You shall stumble by day, and prophet also shall stumble with you by night. And I will destroy your mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Now, who is God holding responsible for the people's lack of knowledge at this point? The people who are in leadership and should be speaking the full truth to them. Now you feel good about yourselves. Well, it's really not my fault. I just wasn't told the truth. No. In this case, who's the charge leveled against? God's priests. Do you know what you and I are? We're God's priests. You know whose responsibility it is to communicate God's truth to the inhabitants of the land? It's our responsibility. My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Now, who is God's people? Who's he referring to? Well, he says it right up here. The inhabitants of the land. Who lives in this land? Is it just a select few? No, it's everybody. So if you were feeling good about yourself and thinking that there was the bad group out there and the good people in here, the reality is that God is saying, you who have the knowledge, you who are my representatives, you who are the priests, need to speak the truth to the inhabitants of the land. And it really does become an Isaiah kind of a condition. You're going to speak the truth, they're going to laugh, they're not going to, well, how long, God? Well, just keep doing it. But they don't like it, they don't want to listen to it. That's okay, just keep doing it. Your job is not to be responsible for the result, your job is simply to be faithful to the call. Just continue to speak the truth. My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being priests to me. So this is our job as priests of God. It is to pursue knowledge and to pursue wisdom daily. I heard it said this way a few weeks ago in a podcast I was listening to, and the pastor was saying that he's asked all the time about where he gets sermon ideas. He said, it just blows me away. And it's a pretty well-known pastor. He says, it just blows me away. He says, here's all these other top dog pastors coming to me and says, well, this is a great sermon. Where'd you get that idea? What a great series. And he says, I opened the Bible and I read it. And the stuff just started jumping out at me. As a priest, it is my job. As a priest, it is your job to pursue wisdom. Actually to court it, to woo it. There's a lot of language in the Proverbs that almost talks about this almost human-like dynamic of a courting and wooing process that takes place between you and wisdom. And you must be enticed and drawn to it and want more.
What I would was a young guy, as to what you just said, young guy who started the ministry, and an older pastor said, if you read the Bible, you'll never run out of sugar material. Just read the Bible. That's what he told me. Old guys know what you're talking about.
All right, let's turn over to, well, it would be your, the back side of your first page. A couple of action points for you this week, and then we're going to look at a couple of proverbs that I think are going to basically just capsulize our intent for the whole series here. This week I want you to give some thought to your all of your life. Not just the areas you excel at. Some of us are good at making money. We're not so good at managing what we've made. Some of us are good at managing money, but we're not very good at making enough. Or we don't know how to make enough. Some of us are great at all elements of money, but we're not so good at relationships. Some of us haven't ever decided yet what we want to live for that's more than just the here and now. I want you to look at all of your life. I want you to look at why you think you're here. Like, do you even know why you're here? And if you do know why you're here, all the reasons for why you're here, like if God were to construct the person to fill the shoes that you're now filling, what would that person do? Month by month and year by year. I don't mean minute by minute. I don't mean analyze your life like, well, would God's person get a cup of coffee? That's not it at all. If God were to create a person to fill your shoes, what would that person do in the month by month and the year by year of life? That's a different way of understanding your purpose. Where do you need more wisdom to do that? Have you been living under the shadow or in the shade of the areas that you excel at while you fail to look at or even admit there's areas in your life where you're floundering and very weak? You've heard me say again and again that we're a learning community. That's why I said every single one of us lacks wisdom in certain areas. And we're never going to talk about that unless we bring it out into the light of day. And here's the difference between you before God's grace and you after God's grace. You before God's grace has to hide what you're doing wrong. You have to suppress the truth, because that's what people who aren't living in the freedom of grace do. They have to suppress the truth in order to feel good about themselves. Every time that you, as a citizen of a kingdom of grace, stray or err, now that you are a citizen of that country, that's a chance for you to see your heart revealed. Every time that you do something that you're not happy about, that you know is less than God's standard for your life, once you're a citizen of the kingdom of grace, that is a chance for you to see your heart exposed for just a fleeting moment before you cover it back up. And you will. And in that moment, you can choose, do I want to learn from what I see? Before grace, you have to hide the areas that aren't good. After grace, we can all come out and we can say, I understand this part of my life is not good. I need some help to change it. I think it might surprise you that I'm going to say that assembled in this room, there's a lot of wisdom. Well, actually, it shouldn't surprise you. You should say you're darn right there is. Assembled in this room is a lot of wisdom. We just don't have wisdom about the same things. And the problem is that we still hide because we still live as if we are individuals that live before grace. Where I have to hide the deficiencies in my life. We can never be a learning community as long as we hide everything that's wrong with us and only put out what's right with us. Isn't it true? And so where do I take the parts about myself that I don't like and I want to change? Usually we take them back to the confines of our own room and we look at them in secret. Isn't that a little bit like doing what's right in your own eyes? Because isn't the wisdom that you already have what took you to where you are right now? So who are you going back to consult when you go back to your own room and consult yourself about the area where you're weak? I'm just saying that. You can analyze that on your own. But it seems like turning to yourself, the one person who has gotten you into this mess, might be the wrong person to turn to at that time. And yet it's very understandable that we would turn to that person, because what do we get when we come out into most communities and we talk about our weaknesses? Well, nothing good, that's for sure. I want us to be a community that is willing to talk about, not in drippy, sappy, disgusting terms, "Oh, woe is me, I'm such a mess." Not that. You need to just stop laughing at me. But you know what I'm saying. There's a difference between, "Oh, woe is me, I am a sinful wretch before God." Well, that might be true, but that's not helpful right now. Let's just talk about the specifics. Where are you? How can I share my wisdom with you? How can I listen to your wisdom and allow it to speak into my life? All right, let's take a look at a couple of Proverbs and then we have to be done. Maybe the rain will hold off so that we actually get a little bit of playground work done then. "In everything, the prudent acts with knowledge, but a fool flaunts his folly." You're all wise people. What is that saying? See, we're actually going to have a Bible study here for a moment, not a Bible teaching session. I could talk all day. You know that, so don't tempt me. This is your turn to talk. "In everything, the prudent acts with knowledge, but a fool flaunts his folly." Well, I see at least one head nodding. That's a sign of deep internal thinking, but let's share some of that thinking.
Not only do we make bad decisions, but we show everyone else the bad decision we're making.
And we're pretty proud of it too, right? We flaunt it. Isn't this a great decision that I've made? When you think of the word prudent, if you were to have artistic ability — I do not — but if you were to have artistic ability and you could draw a person who is prudent, what would that person look like? Is that an odd question? You're looking at me a little funny.
Careful.
Yes, they'd be careful. What would a careful person look like?
A thinker.
See, we don't tend to think of prudent people as being exciting people to be with. As a matter of fact, I know they're not the same, but I think I'm afraid sometimes that we think of prudent and prude as being very closely aligned. But here's what it's saying. A thoughtful, a deliberate person will acquire knowledge necessary. Do you believe that you're going to have difficult decisions to make sometime in the next 5 years? Do you know from past experience — this is the beauty of experience — do you know from past experience that you will not have all the information you need at the time when you need to make the decision?
Yes.
What would you do in the gap between now and then? Even though you don't know what the then is, and you don't know when, what should you and I be doing in the gap between now and the time when we will have to make it? Difficult decision.
Acquiring more knowledge so that we're able to make that decision.
Yes. Do you court knowledge and wisdom? "Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm." Now, we have looked at this proverb before. As a matter of fact, we have beat this one to death, I have to say. And I didn't really discover that. It was on my short list of ones that I wanted to deal with today, and then I looked at that and I said, "Oh my, this is a rehash." So I'm sorry for the fact that it's a rehash. But it's still good. That's why it's good to cut. Have you ever forgotten what you know?
No.
Have you ever read a scripture and thought to yourself, "Wow, that's profound," and then realized, "I just read that 2 days ago." "Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm." There's a phrase that motivational speaker Jim Rohn used to use. And he said, that we tend to become like the five or six people that we hang around with the most. Now, I'm not asking you to keep a time log, but I'd like you to just do a quick mental inventory. You have X number of waking hours in the day. Who are you exposed to during that X number of waking hours? And would you say that most of them are wise and would be helping you to make better decisions? Or would you say that most of them are at best neutral? Now, here's the thing. You can't control who you're going to be with all day long. You're thrown into a work environment. Maybe you have to be with certain other people or have to be with them at least until you can get other different situations. I hire the people that I'm going to surround myself with, which makes it doubly distressing sometimes. Apparently, I don't have wisdom either. But if there is a large block of your time, and here's where I'm going with this, if there's a large block of your time that you cannot control who you're going to hang around with, then what should you be doing with the select minutes or hours of your day where you have a choice about who you can be with? If you will become like the five or six people, an average of the five or six people that you hang around with the most, what should you be doing? If you're not already, right? And if you're the average, what does that say? You're the middle ground. And I'm not saying that this is gospel truth, but it's a very interesting way to look at life. If you're always the smartest and wisest person in the company that you run with, what does that say? Well, I know if you're the fool, it says, well, it's fine.
You're not gaining.
You're not. So you need to have a chance to give, but you also need to have a chance to receive. And if you're always the smartest person in the room, you're never going to receive anything. What does it feel like not to be the smartest person in the room? It feels like you're out of control. You're no longer in control of what's going to happen. Somebody may best you with something. You thought you were pretty smart, pretty witty, had a good saying for everything, and here comes this guy who's actually more profound than you are. But it's okay. Which do you value more? Looking smart in the moment or building a legacy that matters? Because if your choice is to build a legacy that matters, and come back to the book of Judges, instead of this constant cyclical destruction and building back up, destruction and building back up, if you would like to build for future generations, then hang around with some other smart people. It's okay occasionally to be the dumbest person in the room. It would elevate your average over a period of time. But look at this, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Let's unpack that a little bit, because sometimes we read these things, we nod, but we really don't understand the implications of it. How do we define what a foolish person is? They're wise in their own eyes, and therefore they're not willing to take the counsel of others. Do you remember the statement? In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what? Well, that's an intro. Is that the Bill Enslin paraphrase, whatever they wanted? Yes. They did what was right in their own eyes. What happens if you were to put a room full of people who each did what was right in their own eyes? Well, we read about it already. Remember in Romans? Paul actually describes for us what would happen if you put a community together that was built solely on people who did what was right in their own eyes. Disaster pursues sinners, but the righteous are rewarded with good. And so he reinterprets his previous statement. Now here's an interesting one. The wisest of women builds her house, but folly with her own hands tears it down. Have you ever felt like you were in a season of life where you were spinning your wheels? What if it's possible that this is not talking about two different people, but actually talking about the same person? What if this is saying that part of us is building up and building good and building into, and yet the part of our lives that we keep in the shadow of the good part, the part where we are not wise and we don't want to look at that, is actually tearing down the good that we're building in another area of life? Another interesting podcast I heard, and it was a little unsettling actually. And this was a pastor that was, again, this was an elite pastor's kind of thing. It was a leadership conference. And he must have had some really tough words to say to his audience, because he took the audience through the history of modern Western Christianity and some of the people that we would call the heroes of modern Christianity. And he described what was happening in their home lives while they were off doing God's work. And in one case after another, and I'm not going to name any names now, and I don't have time to get into the stories, but in one case after another, he described people that were out doing things that were marvelous for God. And those in the general public thought that these were immensely godly people. And meanwhile, their families were flat out languishing. I mean, in some cases, they were literally destitute. They couldn't feed themselves. Their kids were put off to school somewhere that, I mean, miserable, disgusting conditions. Because they could never look at all of their lives as a comprehensive whole. We don't want to be like this woman, building up with one hand, tearing down with the other. That's the absolute opposite of the life of integrity. Where in all areas of our life, we're striving toward the same thing. Now maybe you've found this out. If I'm going to build in all areas of my life in the same way, it's a slower go, isn't it? It's going to take decades to get somewhere, not years. If I thrust all of my energy into just one thing, I can build it quickly. I've been guilty of this, I can't tell you how many times. I'll just pour all of who I am, all of what I have, into this one thing, and it'll be successful. Yeah, and it might be, but everything else in my life is falling apart around me because I'm so focused on this one thing. Remember the question I asked you just a few moments ago? If God were to create someone to fill your shoes, that were to do the things that He envisioned for you to do, what would that person be doing? Understand the big roles that you have in life and what God would want you to do to lead under His leadership in all of those areas of life. Last verse, and then we have to wrap this up. The scoffer seeks wisdom in vain, but knowledge is easy for a man of understanding. There's a couple of ways that we could spin that, but I think one of the ways is to say that there are people who think they want to be smart, but in the end they're not going to live out what they find out. That was good. I just made that up. I need to say that again. They're not going to live out what they find out. Well, it's amazing what comes out of my mind sometimes. I have no idea where it was. They're not going to live out what they find out. Now, what does that do to us when we repeatedly suppress what we know? We've already seen what happens to people who suppress the truth. What happens when we start to suppress what we know? But knowledge is easy for a man of understanding. And I believe that maybe the best way to interpret that verse in light of what we've already seen is, but knowledge is easy for the man of understanding. Have you ever learned something about yourself that you found disappointing? That's never easy. So it's not easy in the sense that, oh, that was good news. It's easy in the sense that the man of understanding says, it's better that I find this out about myself now and fix it, then I never discover it and deal with this my whole life. And if you tie that to the previous verse, it's better that I find this out about myself today while there's still a chance to turn my life around in this area so that the house that I'm building with one part of my life, I'm not tearing down with another part. It's better I find out the truth about myself today so I can take corrective action. And then tomorrow I'll be wiser than today. Yes, and we're done.